So the next thing we should look at is what were the actual scientific arguments prior to Galileo's conversion that he's bringing to the Inquisition? He goes to Cardinal Bellarmine. Again, he's up on the hook in the late 1620s, early 1630s. What are the scientific arguments that he brings to the Inquisition as proof?
Well, those scientific arguments would get an F in today's colleges or universities. One of them was that the rotation of the Earth is needed to produce the tides. And even that was specious because Galileo could only account for one tide, but the Earth has two tides per day. So that one was easily thrown out. And then he had the idea that, well, because he found that the moon had a rough surface and Aristotle said it had a smooth surface because it was outside of the Earth's environs, and it was one of the celestial bodies, it was perfect, and therefore it was smooth. And since he found a rough surface, well, that just proves Aristotle was wrong, so now we found a crack in Aristotle, so let's go after him all the way. And then he found the phases of Venus, and Ptolemy's model was as accurate as it was. You know, everybody thinks Ptolemy's model was so inaccurate, but it was very accurate. And that's because he invented this thing called the equant that allowed the planets to revolve around the sun in non-uniform orbits. And so that made up for a lot of the mistakes that the Greek heliocentrists had produced, namely Aristarchus. So Ptolemy's model was pretty good, but he couldn't account for the phases of Venus. Now, Venus, when you look at it from Earth, will have phases just like the moon does. And because he put Mercury and Venus in the wrong place with respect to the sun, that's why his model couldn't account for those phases. But he was pretty clever because he knew he didn't know the distances to the planets in his model. So he left six variables in his model so that if and when the correct distances could be found, excuse me, then his model could be adjusted and could account for the phases of Venus. And that did happen, actually, with Tycho Brahe. Tycho Brahe adjusted Ptolemy's model and put Mercury and Venus in the right place, and the phases of Venus were then accounted for. But prior to this, excuse me, Galileo said that Ptolemy's model wasn't correct because he couldn't account for the phases of Venus. And everybody thought that was a pretty good argument, you see, because, well, if you can't account for the phases of Venus, then something's wrong with your model, obviously. And so Galileo got a lot of people on his side with that argument. And then he looked at Jupiter, at least as the story goes. There were several other people that were looking at Jupiter through telescopes, but somehow it landed on Galileo's doorstep that he was the one who did this. But they saw moons, at least four moons of Jupiter's moons, going around Jupiter. And so the supposition from that was that, well, if the smaller body is going around the larger body, well, why isn't the smaller Earth going around the larger Sun? And that seemed like a plausible argument, especially about 50 years later when Newton came along with his equations of gravity and force, the most famous being F equals ma, and that was used to show that the smaller body would have to go around the larger body. At least that's what everyone thought at that time. So when Newton came along, he basically put the seal on Galileo's supposition about Jupiter's moons. So these were some of the arguments that he had to deal with, and Bellarmine was his great antagonist. Actually, prior to Galileo, there was another person who was promoting heliocentrism probably as vehemently as Galileo did, and that was Father Foscarini. And Father Foscarini went head-on into Robert Bellarmine, and as a matter of fact, Foscarini wrote a book on heliocentrism that was published. And then the church found out about that a year later, and banned the book. And then Father Foscarini died about 3 or 4 months later. But at any rate, Galileo was not the first. Foscarini was the first, and as a matter of fact, Foscarini was the first one to try to interpret scripture in light of heliocentrism, a year before Galileo took his hand to it. As a matter of fact, that's where Galileo learned to do it, was from Father Foscarini. And so, and this was what made Galileo's case a little bit more prominent, because now for the second time, we've had somebody come along and try to make scripture correlate with heliocentrism. So the church finally said, all right, we got to put our foot down on this one, and which they did, and that's why Galileo became the poster boy at that time for the church's staunch position against heliocentrism. So anyway, so those are the arguments that Galileo had, and Bellarmine answered each one of them and said, these are not proof. We need some. If you want to promote this theory, that we need some positive proof. And see, Bellarmine knew about relativity. He knew, and even in Galileo's time, they knew about relativity. In other words, what I'm saying is, if relativity is true, you can't tell which body is going around which body. You see. You have to be able to have some other kind of experimental evidence that shows you which one of those two possibilities is correct. The only thing Galileo had in his hand was the fact that he could see moons going around Jupiter. That's not relative. Jupiter's not going around its moons, you see. So he did have that in his hand, but that was no proof that the Earth was going around the Sun, you see. And as things progressed, you know, as I said, Newton came along and with his formula F equals ma, gave everybody the impression that the Earth had to go around the Sun. But 200 years after Newton, Newton's theory was basically set aside, at least in a partial way, because Ernst Mach said in the late 1800s that Newton basically forgot to add in the rest of the universe, you see. If you have only the Sun and the Earth, well, of course the Earth would have to go around the Sun. But if you expand the system now to the rest of the universe, well, now you have a whole different story. And this is what modern physics basically has shown us. And as I was trying to say before, we've come a long way in 400 years with our scientific knowledge. Now we know that Newton basically has a lot of flaws in his system, not only with that issue, but with many other issues. And so Ernst Mach said, well, no, as a matter of fact, the way it would work is if you include the whole universe can rotate around its center of mass. And the center of mass became an important issue because this was one of the hallmarks of Newton's teachings, that a body in rotation will go around its center of mass. Well, Mach said, well, let's just make the Earth the center of mass for the universe. Is that possible? Well, it certainly is possible. You see, and now you get into the relativity issue, because now you have to decide, well, if that's possible for the universe to go around a fixed Earth that's the center of mass for the universe, how can we tell the difference between that and a system where the Earth is rotating in a fixed universe? Well, the answer is you can't, you see. And so that's what Ernst Mach brought to the table in science 200 years after Newton. And Einstein basically developed his theories on the Machian perspective of cosmology. That is, general relativity theory basically agrees with Mach and says, we can't tell the difference between an Earth rotating in a fixed universe or a universe rotating around a fixed Earth. Both of them are accurate, true, and plausible. Which one is true, science can't tell us. At least general relativity science can't tell us. So anyway, these are the issues that Galileo brought up to Bellarmine, and they were all shot down by the church. There is an important issue here that I should bring up, that in 1820, a man wrote a book. His name was Canon Satelli, Giuseppe Satelli. And he wrote a book on astronomy, and was presenting heliocentrism as a thesis or fact. That hadn't been done in quite a while, okay? Not since Foscarini. So this immediately raised the hackles of the master of the palace, That's the, they used to call the head of the CDF back then. His name was Father Anfossi, Filippo Anfossi, and he rejected an imprimatur for Satelli's book based on the fact that he said, look, the church decided against Galileo 200 years ago, and that was the decision that was laid down, and we cannot go against it. And he had an opponent, and his name was Maurizio. His name is slipping me now. What was his last name? Olivieri. Olivieri.
Okay.
Maurizio Olivieri, who was who had just gotten elected to the he was the commissar of the index at that point. And so him and Fossi went to battle, and this battle took, oh gosh, it went probably on for a year or so. And the reason this is important is because Olivieri got the ear of Pius VII and convinced Pius VII that Canon Satelli should have an imprimatur for his book on astronomy that was promoting heliocentrism. And this was quite a scene because just 6 years prior, Pius VII had just been restored to the Vatican after being kidnapped by Napoleon and made the Vatican a police state, and had shipped off Pius VII to Florence for 5 years. And Pius VII was basically ill at this time in 1820, and he was a very weak pope. He just didn't want to fight, and that's what Olivieri said about him. The pope doesn't want to fight.
Well, because he had fought so long with Napoleon, and it's got psychological torture, and all his writing taken away from him, and Napoleon would come in and tell him things that just simply weren't true. The whole church had basically moved on without him. They said we don't need a pope. We'd gotten rid of the papacy, and he wasn't allowed to have correspondence with anyone that would tell him different.
Yeah, yeah. So you can see the psychological strain that this man was under. Okay, Olivieri was a very strong man, very strong, and Fossi was strong too, but not strong enough, especially the way Olivieri had handled this. And this is. The important part about it is this. The church in 1616 under Pius V and, Paul V and 1633 under Urban VIII had made two declarations that said that heliocentrism was a formal heresy. Okay? That's significant. Formal heresy. Now, so the message was clear from the church that this theory of heliocentrism was condemned and nobody was to teach it, okay? So what Olivieri did, ingenious as it was, but it was devious, he made up two reasons why the Church of 1616 and 1633 had condemned heliocentrism, and they had nothing to do with what the church said in 1616 or 1633. What he told Pius VII were basically two lies. The first lie was that, well, the only reason the Church of 1616 had condemned heliocentrism was because everyone thought that if the Earth moved or rotated, that the atmosphere would be sucked away by outer space because, the Earth was moving. All right? And the second reason why the Church condemned heliocentrism was because the model that Galileo was using was right from Copernicus, and Copernicus didn't have the elliptical orbits that Kepler had invented, you see, many years prior. And we know now, you see, because we're smart astronomers, we know now that the elliptical orbits of the planets make it accurate. We can predict where these planets are going to be because they have elliptical orbits. And so these are the two lies that Olivieri told Pius VII, and the Church of 1616 and 1633 said nothing in the way of elliptical orbits as the reason why they condemned heliocentrism nor that they were afraid that the Earth's atmosphere would be sucked up by outer space if the Earth moved. But these were made up by Olivieri, and he convinced Pius VII by these two lies to give an imprimatur to Canon Satelli, you see. Now, interestingly enough, on the commission with Olivieri was Cardinal Capillari, and Cardinal Capillari became Gregory the 16th in 1831. And in 1835, Capillari, now Gregory the 16th, took Galileo's name off the index without saying a word, you see. So we can surmise that, well, since he was good friends with Olivieri, he believed that the two lies that Olivieri had made up and told to Pius VII were sufficient for him to take Galileo off the index in 1835, you see. So that's why all this becomes very important. That question that you asked in the beginning, what proof did Galileo bring to the church, becomes very important now when we have a cardinal of the Catholic Church making up two lies to tell the Pope as the reason why heliocentrism should be allowed. They were scientific reasons, you see. And the same thing Galileo was trying to browbeat the church with was his scientific reasonings, you see. And now we know, first of all, we know that elliptical orbits are not the answer to how the planets can revolve around the sun, because even elliptical orbits don't answer the question. They're not as accurate as people think they are. There's too many perturbations between the planets for elliptical orbits to work precisely. If you used elliptical orbits alone, Saturn would be off at least 1 degree per year. And we would lose track of it. And many other planets have problems with elliptic orbits. But that's what Olivieri believed then, you see. Kepler was the king of astronomy then, and so everybody figured, well, since Galileo didn't use elliptical orbits, well, that's why his model was flawed. So there's a lot of mischief going on in this history that a lot of people don't know about, but I thought it was important to lay it out for them.
Add to that Pius VII has no way to verify these particular claims because the archives had been stolen by Napoleon, just like so much art and everything else that he'd plundered out of Italy and sent back to Paris. And even today, not all of it has trickled back from Paris, and it's in complete disarray. In fact, the Vatican even gave a documentary to somebody, I don't remember what that, I think it was History Channel for something, and they were going over this fact, and they were showing, you know, the archives that they're all are allowed to be viewed. And the guy who was explaining it, they didn't quite do the right on the subtitles. I was listening to what he said in Italian, and it was rather more, he was saying that it's still a complete disarray, still a mess, trying to figure this and out, you know. And so if that's the case today, Pius VII couldn't even have gone and looked at it.
Yeah. So they were gone from 1809, and they weren't returned, at least the portion that was returned, until 1845. Now, that's 10 years after Gregory took Galileo off the index. It's 25 years after Satelli was given his imprimatur, okay? So how are you going to make decisions of this gravity without the very text that you need to study? And so this is why Olivieri went back to the index that Benedict the 14th dealt with in 1741 and 1758. That's all he had to go by, and even that was distorted because Benedict the 14th had made some statement in his index. First of all, Benedict the 14th kept Galileo, Copernicus, Zuniga, Foscarini, and Kepler. That's interesting, isn't it? Kepler was already on the index. So the question is, why could Olivieri give an argument using Kepler's elliptical orbits if Kepler was already on the index in 1741 and 1758, you see? So that just passed by. That just went over everybody's head, okay? And those were the only records they had to go by, so they already knew that Kepler was on the index. So what are they using this guy for, okay? So a lot of chicanery is going on here. I mean, Pius VII was so weak, and as you said, he didn't know the science to refute it. How could he? And then what was happening at this time were all the newspapers had found out about Canon Satelli being denied an imprimatur. You can imagine what the hay they made of that, especially in Paris. all the major newspapers in Paris were saying, oh, the church is so behind the times, you know, because they're not giving an imprimatur to Satelli, and then Germany caught on, and all the other countries, Spain caught on, and they were all saying the same thing. So the church was being bombarded by the press for not giving an imprimatur to Satelli, you see. So they were under a lot of pressure, and being as weak as a pope as he was, Pius VII, it was just a matter of time before he caved in. Even as strong, and he Alfonsi tried to hold on as long as he could, but Olivieri was a great political machine. He got everybody on his side, and there you have it.
Really fascinating history. And in case anyone thinks we've got a bit into the twilight zone here, we're going to get a bit further down the rabbit hole, because then 50 years after this, Einstein comes on the scene. And in particularly when an experiment happened in 1886, which said, well, wait, we've got proof for all these other things, but we should have absolute proof rather than just theory for why the Earth moves around the sun. So let's get out and prove it. So then scientists Michelson and Morley produce an experiment to measure the speed of the Earth's rotation, and they get, according to the textbooks, a null result, and they had to figure out why. And then Einstein produces the reasons why and becomes the new darling of science. Let's talk a little bit about that. What was the Michelson-Morley experiment exactly, and how did this affect the scientists today, including Einstein?
Yeah, let me go back a few years to get some history of that. In 1818, Dominique Arago, a French scientist, had done experiments with light. And basically, one of the interpretations that would make it all understandable was that the Earth wasn't moving, okay? And everybody was scratching their head. How can this be? How can this be? So Arago called on another French scientist, Armand Fizeau. As a matter of fact, you can see all the names of these scientists at the Eiffel Tower. They have them all written there. These were all very famous French scientists. They were the premier scientists of their day. I went to the Eiffel Tower and saw those names, and it was rather amazing to see that by at least a quarter of the two dozen names they have up there are all dealing with this very issue of whether the Earth moves or not. So he contacts Armand Fizeau, and Fizeau figures out, well, let's do this. Let's just say, and Augustin Fresnel was another one he contacted, and how can we explain this? You know, our experiments are showing that the Earth isn't moving, you know, and our whole science is based on the fact that the Earth is moving. So how can we answer this? So Fresnel comes up with this thing called the Fresnel drag theory, and it's a complicated theory, so I really can't go into it right now, except to tell you that it was a theory that said that the ether was dragged in an amount that masked the fact that the Earth was moving, and it made it appear as if the Earth was standing still. Okay, that's what it amounts to. So don't ask me what ether is yet, but that was it. Everybody believed in ether, so he figured, well, let's use the ether and say that it was moving space in such a way where it made it appear as if the Earth was standing still when it was actually moving. You see, so this theory, which was developed in the 1860s, lasted for a little while. And then a guy named George Bedell Airy, an English astronomer from the Astronomie Royale, I mean, this guy, he was as high up as you can get in the scientific world, and he did an experiment that used two telescopes to view starlight. One was filled with water, one was filled with air. And his conclusion was, wow, it looks like the Earth isn't moving, okay? 1871. So George Clerk Maxwell, James Clerk Maxwell, in the 1860s had contacted Albert Michelson and said, you know what, maybe you can do an experiment to try to figure out whether the Earth is actually moving or not, because all of these experiments we've done show that it's not moving. If you look at it, you know, with fair eyes, fair scientific eyes, and you don't put in all these fudge factors to make it appear as if it's moving. So he says, okay. So he did it in 1881, was the first time, worked by himself, and lo and behold, he found, wow, the Earth isn't moving. And so they said, well, we've got to do this experiment again. So they did it in 1887, and this time they got Alexander Graham Bell to fund the operation, and they made the instruments more sensitive than they were in 1881, and they did their experiment, and lo and behold, what happened? Well, it looks like the Earth isn't moving. And they were using the same principles of light that Arago had used in 1818. So there was really no difference. And they couldn't use Fresnel's drag theory to answer the question because it was simply too big to answer the results that they found in 1887 with Michelson and Morley. So everybody is just like in bewilderment. The whole scientific world's in bewilderment because they firmly believe that these experiments would show the Earth was moving. And the first scientist to try to give an answer to it was Hendrik Lorentz, a Dutch physicist. And he came up with this theory. He says, well, if we can't use Fresnel's drag theory, and I have the letters, as a matter of fact, that Lorentz was writing back and forth to Michelson and Oliver Lodge, and these are all in my DVD. As a matter of fact, people can see the actual letters that these guys are writing back and forth talking about this stuff. So Lorentz writes a letter to Michelson saying, you know, how do you explain this, Michelson? And Michelson says, I don't know. I haven't the slightest idea how to explain this. It's his own experiment, and he doesn't know why it's showing the results that it's showing. So Lorentz says, well, I'm in collaboration with another scientist. His name is Fitzgerald from Ireland, and I've come up with a theory. And that theory is that the reason Michelson's apparatus looked, it made it appear as if the Earth wasn't moving was because the apparatus shrunk because of the pressure of space as the Earth was going around the sun, you see. So in other words, as the Earth is going around the sun through space, the pressure of space is shortening his apparatus just enough to make it appear as if the Earth isn't moving. That was his theory. And they called it the Lorentz contraction theory, okay? And these are grown men, actually, you know, writing these letters back and forth. This is not child's play. This is serious business. And Fitzgerald from Ireland says, you know what? I came up with the same theory almost the same time you did. And so, and now that you, Hendrik Lorentz, have said this, now I can use you as my authority, and I can stop all the people that are laughing at me in Ireland for proposing this theory, you see, because it was laughable to say that the ether was putting pressure on these on the apparatus of the experiments to make this result, whereas ether prior to this was supposed to be a frictionless substance, you see, that provided no pressure on matter. So now they're totally reversing the properties of ether to explain Michelson's experiment. Why? Well, because nobody wants the Earth to be still, fixed in the center of the universe. They need it moving, because all of science is based on the Earth is, that the Earth is moving. Paleontology, archaeology, cosmogony, cosmology, you name it. You go down the list, all of them are based on even Descartes' philosophy, which he said himself is based on the fact that the Earth is moving, you see. So if the Earth is fixed, well, this would just upset the apple cart totally, and we'd have to start from ground one. And not only that, we'd have to worship at the feet of the Catholic Church, you see, because they told us 400, 300 years ago now that the Earth wasn't moving, you see.